Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Hi, we're back to the Neil Haley Show, and it's so interesting. We talked Russian history in the first segment, but now we have somebody who's an educator. He works in schools, but I guess when he's a reality television star. So I'm excited to welcome to the program celebrity Tom Kersting for now E-A-N-E's Surviving Marriage, which will debut on Tuesday, March 24th at 10 p.m. Eastern. Tom, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic, Neil. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have you on the program as well. And getting yourself involved in something like Surviving Marriage, reality television, that's a little out of the box, especially if you work at a school right now, right?
Well, school, I mean, I actually have two completely different professions. I'm been a counselor in a high school for 20 years. I'm also a licensed psychotherapist, and I own my own private practice. I got into the TV stuff about 7 years ago. I had written a book, actually a weight loss book, traditionally published. And they hired a publicist, and they got me some, they wound up getting a couple of TV segments, and I found that I had another skill. So this on-camera ability, apparently. So I've been doing a lot of television stuff for many years. And now the latest thing is Surviving Marriage, a new 9-episode, docudrama series on A&E.
So you're the jack of all trades, Tom, kind of like me. I television, radio, tutoring, consulting, and then also coaching, adults in business and manage social media. We keep busy. Can't just have one thing, it sounds like, Tom, right?
Yeah, well, that's right. And plus the family, and I got kids. Speaking of coaching, I coach baseball for my son, and so forth. But, I'm very excited about this new opportunity. I think this particular show has the potential to reach a lot of married couples. And hopefully get them to change whatever disruptions there are that are affecting their marriage.
So why do you think it happens? Why do you think that in a lot of ways, as we look at the marriage bond, especially religiously, that, it's an important, we're supposed to become one unit. We're supposed to let a lot of our selfishness go to have a successful marriage, that people see a different side of it and get involved in it, and then they have no idea that really a lot of their quirks, a lot of things that they did in their lives have to kind of go to the forget about if you want to have a successful marriage in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, well, it's kind of fascinating because the marriages that are the healthy marriages, couples that you see that are kind of glued together even after 20 years, they know how to communicate effectively. The problem with dysfunctional marriages is in the world of communication. So what does that mean in a world of communication? Well, essentially, the individuals simply don't know how to listen to the other person's point of view, and they get so caught up in their own perspective and how they see things that they fail to open their eyes to understand how their partner sees things. And it turns into just a sort of a battle and a competition that leads to, resentment later on and a destruction in the marriage.
And so communication, so it's key. It's got to be back and forth. It's got to be each person listens.
That's the key, Neil. Listening is the key. Yep.
If you're not listening to theirs, but should you always be trying to fix your spouse's problems, especially if you're a man? That's not a good idea, right? You should just listen. Fix your spouse's problems.
Yeah. Well, the best words for a man is, yes, honey, you're right, honey. No, I'm just kidding. But what's unique about this particular show that I'm doing, that I'm the co-hosting, is, Surviving Marriage, is it takes couples out of their everyday life, and they're actually placed on a remote island. They don't even know they're doing this for 5 days. So they're, they're up against the elements of nature and everything else, and they're being challenged physically, they're being challenged emotionally and mentally, and all of the problems that have been destroying their marriage are sort of left back home, and now they're in this environment where they must rely on one another. They must formulate some sort of a team dynamic in their time there. So it really opens up a lot of old wounds, the show, through a completely different form of what we call extreme marriage therapy.
So by getting away from technology, being in a remote island, having to communicate, that's hard for people, right, if they're not getting along.
Yeah, it is. And what we did on the, for the show also is, everything's metaphorical. So, for example, on the first episode that you'll see is a couple called Cleburne and April. Okay. That'll be on Tuesday night, this upcoming Tuesday. Cleburne is an angry guy, okay, and his wife has been shouldering this guy's anger for years. So we start off right off the bat. They get on the island. They're given instructions. But by the way, as you hike your 4 miles to your next destination and get your next set of instructions, here's a 40-pound bag of rocks, Cleburne. And he's got to carry this 40-pound bag of rocks for, like, 5 miles, you know, so he can metaphorically understand, you know, the struggles and the weight that his wife has been shouldering for all these years. So it's a lot of that stuff throughout the 5 days that they're there, a lot of exercise and activities.
Right. And what about the couples that signed up for this? I mean, we all know reality shows and different things. Was it harder to cast something like this that were willing to put their lives out there, that they have a marriage that could be broken and finished in certain ways? How did that kind of go through that casting process and stuff?
Well, you know, I'm not involved with the casting, but I do know about it from other shows that I've done. And a show like this is definitely not easy to cast, because you gotta have two couples, first of all, that really disagree with one another and are pretty much on the verge of divorce. They now have to agree to do something, you know, that's sort of unique, if you will. But, you know, it's really their last hope. So with the couples that were cast, the production company really did a great job getting fantastic couples for the show with real issues that seem to be doing it for the right reasons, right, because they really want to save their marriage. And this is their last chance to do so. So the viewers will find out. Each episode is a different couple. They'll find out what the ultimate outcome was, whether they decided to stay together or to divorce.
So, Tom, how did you get picked to be a co-host in this?
Well, what happened is, like I said, I've been doing a lot of TV stuff for, you know, I did another show called Monster in Laws for A&E a couple years ago. I have an agent in New York who's, you know, who's one of the best Abrams artists, Mark Turner. And so I'm always in the loop for these different things. You know, with these different types of shows relate to relationships and so forth. So I've kind of positioned myself, you know, in the country as, you know, as the relationship expert guy.
And how did you do that? That's the interesting thing, especially when you talk about your not modest background, but you're not like in Hollywood or anything. You're in a high school, plus have your own practice and stuff. But it's not like you're, you know, in Beverly Hills. How did you position yourself to have this opportunity?
Well, I think first of all, I mean, I'm married myself for 18 years, so, and my marriage is a solid marriage. I have wonderful kids, and it's something that I really take a lot of pride on and work hard at as an individual, you know, as a parent and as a husband. And as a therapist working with all these couples every day at my private practice, and in addition to all this TV stuff, it's kind of the perfect mix for me, at least, to be able to really impart, you know, some good, solid advice to people out there on how to go about doing things the right way in a relationship and in a family.
And they think you're pretty good. But again, to be able to do your own PR, to be able to go out and pitch these things, have agents do all these different things, it's a different animal for sure. So I think you're wearing three hats for sure. You got your school hat, you got your therapy hat, and then you got your brand. And that's getting that out there. And so that's awesome for sure.
Yeah.
Now tell me your experience in Monster in Law. I remember that. That was pretty much a train wreck in ways, meaning the stories from that one, right? I remember
That was. I mean, you know, that was basically, you have couples whose marriage was being compromised by a meddling mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Some sort of in-law, yeah. So basically, that was a little different in the sense I would have to go to the location, you know, to where these people were and really, you know, dig deep into their issues and have them work at coming to some form of a common ground. You know, and it was real hard. I mean, because that was let's talk about casting. Apparently, that show is one of the hardest shows to cast, because now you get, not only do you have the couple that's got to agree, you also have an in-law who hates his or her son-in-law or daughter-in-law, and is going to agree to do, you know, a 3 or 4 day TV show with them to help fix their issues.
How many years was that? I remember watching that. It didn't seem like it was long ago.
That was 3 years ago. They did 2 seasons on A&E. Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because I saw that, and that was a interesting crew. A lot of them could end up up on Maury Povich or
they were on. Actually, the one was on.
The one
family, the Bojanowskis. They were like the star family for out of all the episodes. They were I think the mother is still on Dr. Phil all the time. She's like considered the world's worst mother-in-law.
Do you see yourself, Tom, in here, and you're continuing to step up with the A&E shows to ever have a show like a Dr. Phil at one point that's big? Is that a goal of yours at one point in time?
That's what I would. You know what? Again, that is really what my goal is. My goal is to get out there more and have like my own talk show, or I could reach, you know, people from a different perspective. Because basically, you know, the question, to answer your question earlier, like, how did I get into all this? It's just really me being me. I'm not trying to be some Hollywood star or anything like that. I'm just being myself and trying to get, you know, trying to help the world out there, help people.
I mean, he's not the average, you know, Beverly Hills kind of guy. He tells it straight. Just like you tell it straight. That's good. That's important, for sure.
Yeah, it's straight. It's from, you know, it's straight. It's from the heart. And, you know, I just look at people, and I look at couples, and I look at families, and I say, it does, you know, the ones that are struggling, and I'm saying to myself, it doesn't need to be this way. There's another way. Let me show you how.
How tough is it being identified when you're walking in the community and there's a public figure and people say, I know you from somewhere, or certain things, you go to a coffee shop, or even when you're walking in your school and say, we saw you on TV. How do you handle those things? I mean, I think that the brushing passing, I saw you on television, but how do you deal with the semi-celebrityism of being recognized everywhere?
Yeah, well, I do get that a lot, and it's usually people that don't know I do this, like people at the gym, like people that work at the gym that I go to in the morning. Oh, my God, I saw you on Fox and Friends this morning, which I go on a lot, Fox and Friends. I saw you here, I saw you there, I didn't know you did that. So, I get a little shy, actually, because hey, all right, yeah, thanks. You know, I don't really like it, to be honest with you. I can't notice like that.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of a little.
You're going to be the next Dr. Phil someday, Tom, and you're like, I don't like it, right? But you know what your true mission is, to help others, and you have
to go on a
platform like this to do it.
I mean, I don't get uncomfortable by it when people say, hey, you know, I saw you here or there. It's cool, but I don't want people to misjudge me either and think, like, you know, oh, this guy, just because he does his TV, he thinks he's A, B, or C, or D, because I'm just a regular guy. You know what I mean? That's just
absolutely.
And I just want people to kind of feel my energy and understand that they can change.
So everyone tune in to A&E starting Tuesday, March 24th at 10 p.m. Eastern for Tom Kerstink's Surviving Marriage co-host. Hey, Tom, again, where's the best place we can find information on you so we'll see all the different things you do?
Yeah. Yeah, I put a lot of good stuff out on my website. It's just www.tomkersting.com, or Twitter, it's just @TomKersting. And I have a Facebook page, and that's Facebook and Thomas Kersting. But I put a lot of good content out, blogs, articles, some video clips, some TV stuff that I do. So go out there and enjoy that stuff.
It looks like you like to talk, too. It looks like you could take 15 minutes of your time, especially if you could share to a different audience. I look forward to bringing you on my education show to really go and talk about the education's perspective, especially in your job, and then looking at, in the parent, the marriage relationship, how important that relationship was with the children and modeling that, which you were talking a little bit about before. But good talking to you, Tom. Best of luck, and we'll stay in touch, okay?
Thanks so much, Neil. Take care.
Right, take care, Tom. All right, that was Tom Kersting, and that was the Neil Haley Show today. Fantastic show. Two awesome guests, Russian history, and then also Tom Kersting. Have a great week. Next week, another great test. Good day, everyone. We're back, the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, Neil Haley. And it's very interesting when you have celebrities on the program, but then also seeing some of the new platforms that are coming out and how you learn more about them. So I'm excited to welcome the program celebrity Michael Beasley. And Michael's going to be interesting because we're going to learn, I think, a lot about, I guess, his background before acting. So from Bloodline and much, much more. Michael, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm extremely well. Thanks for having me, Neil.
Absolutely. I'm glad to grab you before you head to Paris. And that was interesting talking off air. So let's go through, I guess, I always like to go into childhood and different things. Did you always want to be an actor, Michael?
You know what? I acted a little bit in high school. I actually did a play with my father, whose name is John Beasley. He's a is a very well-established actor, and he's right now he's currently on The Soul Man with Cedric the Entertainer. He plays his father. He was in The Apostle with Robert Duvall and Mighty Ducks and some of our friends. He's been in a bunch of stuff. So I actually did a play with him in high school. And then I just really wanted to focus on basketball. And be honest with you, my son was born, I wanted to see that whole process of, you know, seeing him walk and all that stuff. And I didn't want to be globetrotting all over the world in that process. So I had to shut it down and reinvented myself as an actor.
Interesting. And, yeah. So the interesting point you make that you kind of reinvented yourself as an actor, but you were very successful basketball player. And that's the interesting fact. The school you attended, first of all, in high school, were you really highly recruited? So, I mean, to say you played professionally, and I know some of the stories from some of the top players that went from the NBA and just things didn't go as they seemed, and they ended up stuck in Europe making a ton of money and working, I mean, playing all over the place. So tell us specifically, were you highly recruited in high school as a basketball player?
I was highly recruited in basketball in high school, but I'm coming out of Omaha, Nebraska, so my mom and dad didn't have, you know, we didn't understand the whole process, to be honest with you. And so I kind of waited too late to decide. And ironically, as you said, I know your school is Pittsburgh. I had a chance to redshirt to Pittsburgh during the Big East days. And had I known what I know now, I would have redshirted. But I just wanted to play. And I ended up going. I said, I just wanted to, you know, just play. So I ended up going to Texas Arlington so I could play right away instead of being redshirted. But, you know, hindsight, I should have went to Pittsburgh. But
So tell me specifically what coach would have been your coach if you were going to go to Pittsburgh? Who was
it? It was Paul. What's Paul's last name? It was when Charles
Smith and all that. That team? Really? Oh, my gosh. Maybe you would have been the last person that saved them, that maybe they wouldn't have been beat by Vanderbilt. You know, if we had Michael Beasley, maybe we wouldn't have not made the mistake with Sean Miller driven playing defense. Maybe you would have defended Barry Goheen.
That could have very well happened.
So you were going to play at Paul Evans. Okay, so you're...
He just came from Navy and he was recruiting me pretty strong in Navy, and then he went to Pittsburgh. And like I said, at the time, Aiken was at the point. And,
yes, Curtis, yeah. So what position were you, a point guard or two guard?
No, I was a two guard.
Oh, man, could you imagine having that person? I can't remember if Demetrius Gore was the three man, Jerome Lane was the four.
Jerome Lane, yeah.
This Pitt team, I still...
That was the heyday.
Oh, see, you never thought you'd get in a radio interview where I go bring up this all this stuff. I mean, Lane and the backboard and all this. This was Pitt basketball. But I remember Paul Evans, when Paul Evans was coaching Navy, and they went to Elite Eight with David Robinson.
David Robinson, yep.
And you were getting looked at by Navy at that time, right? Yeah. When you were watching that on TV and seeing that amazing run by the Naval Academy.
Yep, and I wasn't, to be honest with you, I wasn't interested in going to Navy, but when he went to Pittsburgh, I was intrigued by it. And like I said, I guess, you know, if I just had, you know, if my mom and dad really knew about, you know, the process was to, you know, to get better and this, that, and the other in basketball, I definitely would have redshirted. Like, I would tell my son, if he's in that position right now, yeah, redshirt, get better, get a fifth year, you know. And like I said, in the Big East, when the Big East was the Big East.
Oh, yeah, it was truly the Big East, and was amazing basketball, and the Panthers were just starting to make their run, for sure, with Paul Evans and stuff like that. So that's an interesting story. So you go to Texas Arlington instead, and that's a Division I school, but a smaller D1 school. Did you guys win it all? Did you win it all at Texas Arlington or not?
We won. We had a great team on paper. it didn't come together. But I to be honest with you, I wouldn't change anything because, you know, I formed a lot of great relationships from there. And it also helped me drive myself to because actually what happened was my coach told me that, you know, I wouldn't play. And I was All-American in junior college, by the way. I went to junior college first.
Okay.
And then I went to Texas Arlington. And my coach told me that I wouldn't play after college. So, you know, I just need to get a nice little job. And I said, you know, how can you tell me what's inside of me? You know, I don't even know what's inside of me. So that drove me to, and then had he not said that, I don't know, I probably would have just got a nice little job somewhere. But that drove me to push myself to, you know, try to, you know, play after college. You know, so I worked really, really hard, ended up going to Puerto Rico, and then, you know, the rest is history. So
Puerto Rico, and then after Puerto Rico, they say, well, maybe this guy was a major D1 player once they start seeing you play ball out there, right? And then other teams want a piece of you then, right?
Yeah.
Bigger contracts, bigger opportunities. Who did you play ball against in the pros that people would remember?
I play Robert Reed, he used to play for Houston Rockets back in the day. Lewis Lloyd, other guys you wouldn't probably recognize. A lot of overseas, you know, guys are pretty big overseas.
So that was before the 90s where the bigger contracts came through Europe.
I
had some of the stars on that specifically told stories about, you know, hey, I had to go to Europe. The NBA was, but they paid those big NBA players that were the top stars in that league. So you went ahead, played, and then once you said you had your son, you said, I'm going to have to change my look, and that's acting. And from your dad being an actor, that was pretty easy, right? That's, again, the kind of...
What happened was he was in Atlanta. He was doing a play, and one of the actors didn't show up for rehearsal. So, you know, I was at rehearsal, so I just read his lines, and I was pretty horrible. But I caught the bug at that point and said, you know, let me dabble into this, and had a surreal career so far because I booked my first commercial I went for, which was Cox Cable in Omaha, Nebraska. I booked my first movie I read for, and then. You know, since then I've worked with, you know, I've done over 57 movies and TV shows and worked with, you know, some legends from, Denzel actually cast me for my very first movie that I actually got a chance to work on. Because the first movie I booked, I was doing a play and I couldn't change my schedule to actually do the movie. So the first movie I had a role in was with Denzel, was The Great Debaters. And Denzel actually, I had to read for Denzel Washington and he actually cast me. For my first movie. And then I since worked with him three other times in Flight and Two Guns, and got a chance to work with, you know, in Las Vegas with De Niro and Michael Douglas, Morgan Freeman, Kevin Kline, and, you know, this list goes on. So, you know, it's been a storybook career so far.
So you've been a working actor that has had minor roles, but the thing is, you've worked with some amazing people, but you've seen this business change for sure. What would you say is your biggest break so far before what we're promoting right now? Let's kind of go back with before Las Vegas and stuff like that. What would you say was your biggest role before Las Vegas and things like that? And then now we're going into, I guess, the future, which was Las Vegas, and now all your big deals coming up with Bloodline, and other stations and other opportunities.
Well, I did Still Magnolias on Lifetime. I played Spud, his black version with Jill Scott and Chris Rashad and Queen Latifah. And you know, that was a pretty big role for me. Got a lot of eyes. Las Vegas was really good because they really promoted me. You know, actually had the CBS execs come tell me they were promoting me for the movie, and I was like, you know, you got De Niro and you got in the movie, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so what was it to work with such amazing talent?
It was awesome. I probably would have been starstruck, but I was blessed to work on Flight with Denzel and John Goodman and Don Cheadle and Bruce Greenwood. The project before I got to there. So I was able to work with those guys and then got on the set with these guys. And it was just amazing because I learned, you know, you can learn so much in a book and you can learn so much in class, but when you get in front of these guys and you're seeing these guys, you know, do their thing, it's just like, you know, that's, you can't put a price on that kind of experience because you're learning from the best and the best at their, you know, at their time right now. You know what I'm saying? It's not like they're coming up. They already did their thing. And so everybody was comfortable with what they were doing. And I was just trying to, you know, make sure I was on point in everything I did. In fact, like in Las Vegas, I only was supposed to have one role, one scene in the movie, and with De Niro and Michael Douglas, Kevin Kline, and Morgan Freeman, and you know I did so well in the scene. The director, you know, loved me, and it was like, you know, what are you doing tomorrow?
Wow.
So we want to write you in some more scenes in the movie. I was like, wow. So he wrote me in 9 more scenes in the movie. So you know that. But I, you know, it comes from that experience I'm getting from on the set. Each set I go to, I try to, you know, pick up something and learn something, you know what I mean? So I'm always looking for, you know, ways to get better at my craft.
And that's important. And I think what you all have to understand is if you're a working actor, they like your look, Michael. I mean, so many people go to casting calls and they never get work. When you could call yourself a working actor that's always working and look at the number, if you see your IMDb and see how many different roles you've played, a lot of people are lucky to audition and get on 2 or 3. So you've really living the dream in this area as well, leading to these big opportunities. So would you say that Bloodline is after Las Vegas is kind of where things are getting bigger and bigger for you in your career, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, Bloodline is, you know, but you know, I have several things coming out, and but Bloodline is really, I think, is going to catapult me into, you know, a different space because, you know, I'm working with, you know, so many great actors, and the TV series is so, you know, well done, and I actually got a chance to work with the producers. In Magic City, I did Magic City on Stars, and you know, I got a chance to work with them from that. And so, you know, this is going to, you know, like I said, I think because it's going to get so many people seeing it, you know, already I've gotten a couple offers for movies because of Bloodline already. So, you know, they're still developing, and we're still in negotiations for different stuff, but. Yeah, I think Bloodline is really going to, you know, take me to a different space I haven't been yet.
Well, I think it helped with the, you know, you're getting that reputation from Las Vegas and getting an opportunity to work with such talented people, and then your resume just keeps growing in the opportunities. And if you're hungry and you want to improve in your craft, you're going to work. And if you're easy to work with, you're not a jerk, you're not that kind of person that, hey, and you learned it from basketball. You learned it, hey, I mean, because... Everyone thinks you got to be the best player in basketball to stand professionally. No, you got to be able to get along with coaches. You got to get along with players. So you're in that almost same type of game plan with this other deal. So Michael, tell us about Bloodline because I have not gotten a chance to see it. Now I definitely want to check it out. But tell us a little bit about Bloodline.
Bloodline is a series about the dysfunctional family that they're a rich family on the you know, Florida Keys. They own a boating company where they do a lot of tours, boat tours for tourists and stuff like that. And they have this, you know, tight knit family until the black sheep of the family comes back. And everybody has a secret that they're, you know, that you find out through watching the show that is really a dark secret. And Sissy Spacek is on it, and Kyle Chandler is on it, I can't think of his name. I'm sorry right now, but there's a bunch of great Emmy Award winning actors and legendary actors in this piece, and it's just a song piece. I'm being honest with you, it's a slow burn, but once you see that first episode, you get hooked immediately, and you want to watch all 13 episodes, which is on Netflix right now. So I'm excited to be a part of it because, you know, I know it's going to keep growing. And I'll be honest with you, I think it's going to win some awards this year or next year. Award season is that good.
And so in your character in that opportunity, when you heard about this and said, okay, this is on Netflix, what was your thought process, especially being an actor that's worked in a lot of types of bigger features and things like this, and then hearing about, we talked about this off air, with like PlayStation and now Netflix, all these that are right post-production right onto those stages and that platform. What is your thought process in this changes and I guess the way we think about how producers and features and TV shows are produced now?
You know, I have a production company streaming well, and so I look at all this all the time, you know, the different platforms, and, you know, it's really, you know, like it changed so much from when my father was involved in the business, you know, where you had to be in L.A. or you have to go to L.A. to work and this, that, and the other, where there's so many, you know, I'm doing, everything I've done so far has been out of the Southeast, so it's been out of Georgia or Louisiana, Florida, and there's so many venues now, like, you know, Netflix has their, you know, new programming they're doing, YouTube even has a, you know, they're getting their thing together, and now PlayStation and Xbox have their own networks they're doing. So there's so many different platforms and so many different ways to get the media out there now. It's pretty mind blowing. And you know, I try to get on everything I can. A friend of mine, Samuel Jackson, and you know, and he told me this, to keep working, you know what I mean? And just to keep, the only way you get better at your craft is to be out there working. So
it gives you more opportunities, really, Michael. That's what's nice. Yeah.
And I, you know, like you said before, I took a lot of basketball and put in this because, you know, you never know what your next job is when I was playing basketball, and I don't know where my next job is coming from when I'm playing this. So, you know, I'm staying even keeled. I don't get too bent out of shape with if something doesn't come through. But there's so much happening right now at this time in the Southeast that, you know, I'm always confident that something's going to come through because of the relationships I've built on the set. You know, just like I did, I worked with Contraband, with Mark Wahlberg and his crew, and they loved me so much from that they put me in Two Guns. And so that's because of relationships. And like I said, I get on the set, I'm professional, you know, I don't cause any trouble. I just want to, you know, I do my job and get out of there. So,
right.
But like you said, it's relationships you build because these guys aren't only doing one project.
You know, never, never. So, and you never know the big project where you get a bigger role. Someone gives you that opportunity and you never know if it's going to go or not. And then bam, someone else says, I want you for this role right now. And then somehow it shocks the world. You know, because you see,
and you never know which project is going to be that. Because
you never know.
I've done pilots, and I'm thinking, oh, this is the one. Pilot didn't never happen. The movies are like, oh, this is the one. This is going to get me the end. It just didn't happen.
Like you think about these shows, how things develop and things like, and you say to yourself, like, I loved Resurrection, and I don't know if it's got canceled or not, but look at the top actors, but some of the younger ones that were part of that crew, no one knew of. And then they got on a big show, and then they're the next big thing, and then the next opportunity comes through. And I think what you've been doing is being able to be a working actor is sometimes better than just having one role and then everyone typecast you forever. You can keep going. And the nice thing is you don't have to go to Hollywood anymore, as you said. The nice thing about Atlanta. So I want to go to the PlayStation deal because that's where I was interesting now looking at all these different things as I'm kind of flipping through all your stuff because it's unbelievable. Just telling about the original series Powers on the PlayStation Network. Tell us about that specifically as well. Which one is a bigger role, would you say? The Powers or Bloodline?
Bloodline was a bigger role. Both shows are really good, though. But I only have four episodes in Powers, and I don't make it after the fourth one. So But, you know, I have a great chance of coming back in the second season of Bloodline. But Powers is based off of a comic book, a DC comic book called Powers, of course. And it's about normal people and also people that have powers. They have superpowers. So, you know, it's just like a mixture of, like, people walk around and then they discover they got powers. And then you got the people that want to be like the powers, you know, they want to be like the people that have power. So, you know, they're wearing costumes and stuff like that, and they're trying to fly and they're trying to do certain things that they can't do. So it's a really interesting mix. And but it's a great storyline. It's been some great reviews as far as what they're doing. And again, it was the original one too. It was the first one they did for PlayStation. So it was awesome to be a part of that.
So what was your role in Powers? What did you play there?
I was Shaken. I was actually a police officer at the Powers unit. But unfortunately, I didn't have any powers. So,
you need to say, hey, I should have gotten powers, so now go on the new Heroes that's coming out on NBC. You never know those opportunities. So that's the fun thing about it. Now, your production company, what kind of stuff do you do with your production company?
Well, the first one we're starting out is we're actually doing a documentary on my son Malik Beasley, who is he's an All-American. He's a Jordan All-American in high school right now, basketball player. He's top 25 in the country, and he's headed to Florida State next year. We're doing a documentary just not on him, but also on the what's going on in the college right now, and where, you know, the kids aren't getting paid for you know what they're doing and you know how they can't even wear it. Like, my son couldn't even wear his name on his back and get paid for it, where the colleges get all the money and the shoe companies get all the money. So we just want to cover that. We're not going to ruffle any feathers. We just want to talk about have the conversation, so. We're working on that right now, and then we're working on a couple. We're developing a couple of movie projects and TV projects right now. So it's in the beginning stages. And what I wanted to do is just get on both sides. I didn't want Hollywood to really dictate my career, and so I want to get on both sides of the camera. So and also helps me with my acting as well. So so we're just in the really early stages of. Doing this, but it's exciting and it's hard work too. So
I know how I'm just producing and doing my radio show and then my television show. I have someone else, but I learned that process. But it's so great to be behind the scenes, meaning like watching it and watching somebody produce. And I produced my own radio and television wrestling talk show when I was a pro wrestler. So I did it before, and I saw, and I kind of put myself in the back scenes and not put myself as a star and things like that. So it's interesting to put yourself in that role in certain situations. But I think that's gonna be interesting with the basketball one, because think about this and specific how much money these guys make, especially when you're talking about that for universities and then these one and dones now. What the heck is that? If it ends up being Duke against Kentucky, Michael, all it shows you is that you really don't need – the ones that stay aren't the best, and the ones that don't stay are the best.
And that's the thing is, like, again, that's changed so much where you're getting punished for, say, 4 years. You know what I mean? Because, like, they're looking at these guys like, you're wrong for staying that long. And I don't think that's right for you to be looked down upon because you wanted to stay your 4 years in college. But – they're looking at the one and done's as, better, but what it's doing is it's kind of messing up the league because these guys aren't ready. A lot of these guys aren't ready.
No.
But as when you was a wrestler, it's tough for if you're not going to a big school, like when I went to Texas Arlington, my mom and dad my father was an actor at that time, and they didn't have that much money. So I didn't have money to take somebody out to dinner or something like that, or you know, it was just rough because, you know, we didn't have anything. We didn't have too much money. We only got the state, you know, with whatever money they gave us. From
yeah, that spending money when I was at Western Maryland, it was literally nothing. Right. We were on the road. And right. So you need money in college, and these kids don't. And then they basically get stuck in these specific things to say, hey, I'm going to go take the big contract now and get the heck out of Dodge. But my hope for college basketball is, I guess we want Wisconsin to play Michigan State for the national championship, because then it's showing that these are guys that stayed 4 years.
Right.
Compared to Duke and Kentucky that are just getting these one-and-doners for sure. And your son, do you want your son to stay 4 years? What's your thought on that?
I mean, it just, you know, I'm be honest with you, if he's a lottery pick in one of those years, you know, you can't get any higher than a lottery pick. So we'd have to make that decision at that time. But, you know, we definitely want him to get his degree. That's the most important thing. So, you know, I talked to the school just in case. I said, you know, if he's best to be able to leave early, you know, we need to know that he can come back and get his degree. So, and those things we try to work out, you know, beforehand. But it just really depends. Like, you know, I love for him to stay and get his degree. But, you know, if circumstances dictate other, then we'll have to cross that bridge when we cross it.
What does your son think of this? Because you know all the other ins and outs, how he's going to, and you're a former pro player going to play college ball and having that kind of person to talk to and get the advice from, compared to a lot of the other players that are going that have no idea what's going to happen when they get to college.
Man, I look around and see some of these single mothers, and you know, I just feel bad because they don't know, and I hear it all the time from coaches that, you know, when we're recruiting, it's like, you know, he's blessed to have somebody that understands what's going on, because he, you know, they're taking through the ringer. And me and my son are really, really tight. Like, we have a saying where he says, I'm his other half. You know, we say we're each other's half, where, you know, we're really, really close. So, you know, I tell him, you know, what to expect, and then he has to make a decision on, what he's going to do from what I'm telling him. But you know, I told him 2 years ago, I said, you know, I'm working on my second career, so, you know, you can do this or not, you know. I said, but you have to find a love in what you're doing. You have to find a love in getting in the gym and getting better and all that. So, you know, ever since then, he's just like tonight, he just, after school, he did two workouts. You know, he's leaving tomorrow to go to France to play with the USA team in a tournament. Then he has to come back, and then he's playing in the Jordan Brand Classic in New York the weekend after that, and then he goes to L.A. to play in another All-American game.
Oh, my God. Are you going with him to all these games?
Yes, unfortunately.
So now at least if your son's in the NBA, then I basically have a connection, right, Michael? When
you
he's,
have a connection.
To get him on the show, to get him on the show, or you know, interview him when Florida State plays goes far. So
is he gonna
have a good shot? What is your thought process with Florida State? They weren't that good this year. Do you think putting him in the lineup is gonna change things with the program?
Oh yeah. They're talking about building the program around him. He can put up numbers.
So did Dixon ever come calling him? Was he ever recruited by Pitt? You can't say that.
I know a couple of friends. They got a friend of ours. I can't think of his name. Darren. They got a recruit that is a friend of ours. Malik knows him. That's going there. He signed early.
So
you know, in the recruits again.
Yeah, see, I've not been paying attention because I'm disappointed with this year's team.
His name is Damon Wilson. They got Damon Wilson there, but no, they didn't come after us at all.
I don't know if your son would want to play for a school that honestly doesn't allow you to be a starter your senior year, and that disappoints me about Jamie Dixon. And I'll flat out say this: I mean, I've loved the years of the Pitt, but we went to that Elite Eight and the disappointment against Villanova, and I just think that the game has changed. But Virginia's been able to show that just defense wins, at least. To get further, but not, that's kind of exactly a carbon copy of what Pitt did for years, and also with Ben Hallen. It'll be interesting to see if Hallen can resurrect Mississippi State. That's going to be really interesting to see if that kind of program works anymore. I don't think it does. I hate to say this. I think you need to have defense and offense. You can't just go straight D and go against these top players later on. But that's interesting.
But that's what happened with Florida State this year. They played defense. They're in a lot of games, but they just didn't have any offense. You know, and they got a lot of offensive power coming in. They're going to have two All-Americans coming in, two All-Americans, and my son and Dwayne Bacon, and then they got Terrence Mann, another top 50 guard coming in. So, you know, they're going to have the firepower next year to go along with the defense. So it's going to be interesting to see.
So who's the coach of Florida State?
Leonard Hamilton.
Oh, yeah. So Leonard's just having a down year, right? Because he was awesome with Miami. So
And 2 years ago they won the 2 years ago they won the ACC in 2012. 3 years ago.
Yes.
They won the ACC.
So you have these ups and downs and I think now they have the opening because Syracuse is going to probably be down for a while, and I think UNC will be as well once the whole academic thing goes through. So I know you make the right decisions. What other top schools was he looking at with Florida State? Who are the others?
We were looking at UCLA. And UConn and Wake Forest. Those are the
So he's going to go to a winner then. That's where, and I'm sure you're going to be pumped. You probably, Michael, want to go check out some football games with Florida State, won't you?
Oh yeah.
Now Seminoles for sure. All right, Michael. I don't think you expected me to have a good sports interview with you, but I can do. If you listen to my podcast, you never know my interviews. You never know what you're going to get with me. I don't know if your publicist told you that. I have a conversation, and I'm able to come up with tons of stuff. But I'm interested. When you come to Pittsburgh. Because you're going to, especially if you're going to be traveling your son sometimes to games, and Florida State plays Pitt. You got to look me up for
sure. I got family in Pittsburgh too. So, I got family in West Philly. So it's not in 6 hours from you.
All right.
Yeah. When I get up there, I'll definitely reach out to you.
Absolutely. And I at one point want to act too. And, I'm 6'10" and when I was a pro wrestler, I was about 310 pounds. I'm 270, 280, but I saw
you
one of my
10 wrestler.
Yeah. Pro wrestler, professional. No, we're not talking amateur. We're talking pro. We're talking, The Rock wore my knee pads, in Memphis, Tennessee when I worked for Lawler. So no,
I work with The Rock.
Did you? Okay. The Rock, I knew The Rock before The Rock was The Rock. He was Dwayne. He was Rocky. I forget what the gimmick he was. Something. The days when he was with the USWA, and I was on the same TV taping with him with the USWA. Then I saw him when I did TV for WWF, and he was the only one that didn't say hi from the Memphis days. That was when he was getting his big push.
Really?
Yeah, but what do you think of him? Do you think he's a good guy?
No, he's been, because my father worked with him too. Like, my father was his father and walking tall. He's been a gentleman ever since
Maybe it's just at that point, you never know in this business at that time.
Yeah.
He was a lot younger then. He's matured a lot probably in those years.
I think he matured a lot, though, in my opinion. Because, like I said, I met him a couple of times. He's really, really gentleman.
All right, well, so you see the backgrounds now, Michael. We'll definitely have to connect via Facebook and all these different things and stuff like that. But I appreciate you coming on the show, and I didn't know what to expect. And then when I looked at your background, then I find out your son's a top player. I'm a Florida State fan now, so look, I want him to be top-notch, lighten it up. For Florida State, so then I get my connections into the college game. That's what I want. I really have my connections to the NFL. I have a semi NBA, but mostly retired players. I mean, if you listen, you saw my who's who of interviews. But it's always great to reach out and find those diamonds in the rough, especially when you're looking at this whole game. So it must be exciting. Have a nice trip to Paris. But Michael, where's the best places we can find information on you? Where can we go?
You can get me on Twitter at I am Mike Beasley, or Instagram I am Mike Beasley, or Michael Beasley on Facebook.
All right, Michael. And any new projects are we going to have to wait to find out? Is there anything else coming up that you're going to be on?
I got The Cell. The Cell is coming out. I'm on The Account. The Cell was with Samuel Jackson and John Cusack. that should be coming out this year. I just finished up a project with Ben Affleck and J.K. Simmons called The Accountant, and that's going to be a monster that I think comes out next year. And I did The Nice Guys with, I can't think who it was, but some big heavy hitters. So I got several things, you know, coming out, and then, you know, still in negotiation with a couple of things. So, but I'll let you know as soon as they finalize.
Well, absolutely, and I'll be keeping touch with you on Twitter and things like that and watching your son, because I'm a huge college basketball fan, and I hope that, like I said, we'll see what Pitt does. But if you know, you have the connections to the Panthers too, because your son knows players on Pitt. We got to get those connections, because I that's my team, but I just was disappointed with this year. They have a lot of returning starters, so if somehow they get the right place, they could be pretty good as well. It's the same kind of story as Florida State. But thanks again for calling, Michael. Best of luck and safe travels to Paris.
Thank you, Neil. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, take care, Michael. See you later. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Neil Haley Show. I guess a new Neil Haley Show. Two amazing guests today, Rabbi David Wolpe and also Didi Rittman. So we have a variety of guests, an educator and also someone who's educating us about David. So I'm on the line right now. I'm really excited. This person just got signed by Warner Brothers Movie Studio. He wrote a book called The Divided Heart. David, the Divided Heart, and it's really an interesting book about David and some myths and different things. I'm going to learn a lot, so I want to welcome the program, Rabbi David. Rabbi, how are you? And thanks for coming on the show.
I'm very well and delighted to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so Rabbi David, I guess this has got to be a whirlwind to the whole thing with Warner Brothers, from a point that, you know, you've had great success as a rabbi, but you never thought that it would be a mainstream, that you would be talking all over the world about this, right? For sure.
No, it was very much a surprise. And, you know, when someone calls you and says, I just sold your book about David that I wrote for Yale University Press to Warner Brothers. Is this a crank call? Is that really true? But when you look at the story in the Bible, it's such a powerful and dramatic story that it actually does make sense that someone would want to take this very charismatic, flawed, but inspiring character and bring him to life.
So really interesting, as I'm Roman Catholic, Rabbi David, and also in so many ways really into the scriptures and certain aspects, certain things that you've wrote about, and then how we're going to portray David in this movie and stuff. We've seen a lot of different things, from the Ten Commandments to other movies that have come out on the silver screen.
Right.
Let's talk about David himself. I look at it as a Catholic. David is so important in this process, leading up to the divinity of Jesus in so many
exactly.
ways.
David is a crucial character, exactly as you say, for everybody whose faith in one way or another is rooted in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. Obviously, he's important for Jews because David is the king of Israel whose line is going to lead to the Messiah, and important for Christians because David is the king of Israel whose line leads to Jesus. And so you have to ask yourself, and in some ways, this is really why I wrote the book, because I kept asking myself, why does David get that honor? I mean, of all the characters in the history of the Bible, and there are some remarkable ones, it's David who gets the great promise that the king is going to come from you, and you will have the kingship forever.
Right.
And so you wonder, why does God choose David? He doesn't choose Abraham. He doesn't say that to Moses. He doesn't say it to Isaiah. He says it to David.
Right, exactly. And in this process, and David, in the story of David in the Old Testament, or again, don't mind me on this whole thing, because one of the reasons I booked you on the show is I'm really into Scripture, that he's not really this well-known figure at this point.
I know. Which is a strange thing if you think about it. Most people, if you ask them about David, they know one or two things about his history.
Right.
They know Goliath.
Right.
They know sometimes Bathsheba, but considering how important he is, the story is not nearly as well known as it should be, among people like you and like me who, you know, happen to love reading Scripture and find it an endless source of both inspiration and fascination.
And don't mind me on this, because I'm going to jump into the lineage of King David. Before that was King Solomon, right? Am I going to correct on that?
Right. Well, Saul.
Saul.
Before David,
Saul.
Right? Solomon after.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is that, I mean, and this is one of those mysteries again. So God chooses King Saul.
Yes.
And then discovers that it's a bad choice.
He's not following God's plan.
Exactly. Which is one of the things that you're always perplexed about through the Bible, is how does God manage to make bad choices? You would think God would make only good choices,
right.
But it doesn't happen that way. So once it's clear that Saul is not up to being king, he's put in a job that's too big for him, and he can't handle it both personally or royally. So Samuel, who's the high priest, goes off to anoint David, and the wonderful thing about the scene in anointing David is he comes to the house of David's father, Jesse, and he says, you know, present your kids. And Jesse brings out all seven of his sons, and none of them is the new king. And finally, Samuel has to say to him, are you sure you don't have any more kids? Yeah. And he goes, oh, yeah, there's a little one out back pasturing the sheep. And so you realize that not only does David not seem to be king, his father forgets that he's even home, doesn't introduce him to the company. I mean, can you imagine someone important comes to your house and you introduce all your kids except for one? So we realize that part of the legacy of David is David's very much the underdog. He's the one everyone neglects. And he proves to be the most gifted.
And it's interesting when you're talking about Saul making the wrong decisions. The reason we had the Book of Kings and had different kings involved in this process is because no one could follow God's law. So having a divinity with a leader, hopefully everyone would follow his lead. And a lot of people think of King David after, you know, Goliath and stuff, that he was perfect in so many ways. But so I could jump into so many different conversations about David's mistakes as everyone's mistakes. But you know what I would say, Rabbi David, it's because in human nature we all make mistakes,
I was going to say the book itself is called David the Divided Heart, because the point is that he really was close to God throughout the book. One thing David never does, he never worships idols, he never runs away from his connection to God, but other things pull him in the world, exactly as you're saying. And so I used the subtitle, The Divided Heart, because sometimes the world pulled him in directions that he knew were wrong, as we often know what we're doing is wrong, but he does it anyway.
Because in human nature, we're going to do that, and we're sinners till the end, and hopefully we're no longer after that point, and that certain things lead us. And I think that a lot of the things that we look at with David. So let's go to Goliath, because I know we're going too deep for our listening and viewing audience, maybe, as I could go really deep in these questions with you, because you're a great expert like yourself. Let's go specifically to the whole David-Goliath. You talk about it as a myth. And in a lot of ways, Catholics have finally come to this realization that a lot of the stories in the Bible are mythological in certain ways to teach a theme. And so tell me why you believe that's a myth, David versus Goliath.
Well, I mean, I would say this. There's no way of knowing whether there was a battle or something like a battle. But in the way, it's a myth in the following way, that really David has an advantage. And he has an advantage because he has a long-range weapon. That is, Goliath has a spear, which he can jab at David.
Right.
But David has a slingshot and a bow, a stone and a slingshot. And so he can attack Goliath from a distance. And the remarkable thing is, of course, by the way, they've done studies now of modern Bedouins who use slingshots, and you actually can easily strike a man down. The amazing thing is that only David thought of this. I mean, it was presumably available to anyone in Israel, but David consistently sees the world in inventive and new terms, and nobody else has his gift for expanding the picture and understanding the vision.
Exactly. And so that's interesting. So you don't believe this. We don't know for sure if the story was a myth or not, but you're saying that basically what we talk about, the David and Goliath in sports or in different things, how the little person beat the giant, which I am a giant, David, by the way.